Good afternoon, and welcome to the Council of Public Affairs. I'm your moderator today. My name is Terry Shillington, and just a few rules that many of you will understand. We'll ask you to put $10 per person into the basket on your table and have it ready for Joanne when she picks it up. We thank our partners in this enterprise, the University of Lethbridge and Lethbridge Community College that looks after the audio for us on our website, and Ericsson's. So we'll have a presentation and then a break for lunch, and then we'll come back before 1 o'clock and have questions and discussion. So now let me introduce our guest speaker. Austin Martin is a board member for the Premier's Council on the Status of Persons with Disabilities. He introduces himself as a schizophrenic. He wrote an article actually in November that appeared in the Edmonton Journal around homelessness and schizophrenia, I think it was, and that attracted a lot of attention in the legislature and attracted our attention. He's authored 161 peer-reviewed papers and is an alumnus of the University of Lethbridge, actually. And we welcome his father, Ernest, who's also here supervising Austin. So we're glad they're both here. Anyway, Austin Martin, would you come and speak to us?
Well, the first thing, my dad pointed at himself, and of course most of them were co-authored with various people, so it's not...
The mic.
Can you hear me now? Most of the articles were co-authored with various people around the world. I'll get into that later. I am glad to be here today as your speaker. It is great to be back in Lethbridge again. When I give speeches, people often ask me a simple question. Why in their eyes, not mine, do I seem to function so well? My answer is always that I have never consciously decided to quit taking my meds, my neuroleptics. It has just been over 15 years since I had my first overt psychotic break in Edmonton in 1992. It was a cold, dreary fall day when I first descended into the dark world of madness. It has been a slow ascent back into the light of sanity. I took a severe permanent detour from the academic course of my life into a life of service and advocacy for a group that is, to be entirely honest, mostly despised and feared in the mainstreams of society and certainly little understood. It is my belief that my willingness to be compliant with my medications comes from being blessed with the insight to understand the fact and accept to the core of my being that I am and will remain for the rest of my life a person with schizophrenia. In 1992, when I was... Can you not hear me still? In 1992, when I was in hospital, I wasn't going to take my medications, and my father came up from Lethbridge and talked with me for 3 hours and persuaded me to take my medications, and I have consistently since that point. And unlike at least 80% of people with schizophrenia that do not take their medications religiously. I believe the lack of this insight and acceptance by many of my peers results in the 80% of hospitalization admissions and psychotic breaks after initially being stable on their medication regime. Lack of compliance with medication is such a huge problem for the medical community that it seems that most psychotherapy, talk therapy, for schizophrenics is for the express and specific purpose of gaining compliance with treatment protocols rather than learning to deal with their new life as a schizophrenic. I don't think the same thing would happen to those that are newly blinded or paralyzed. The emphasis is on the learning to deal with the new changed reality of their bodies, and in our case, and also their social dynamics. A diagnosis of schizophrenia is just as dramatic a diagnosis, if not as visible. Acceptance is the fundamental ideal of many of the world's ancient philosophies and religions, and can be a powerful tool to self-empowerment. When you accept your destiny, a peace can descend on your existence. I have had to accept the limitations of my reality and work within those limitations to say, to, as my wife says, be happy and healthy as I am capable of being. It might not be the life I dreamed of or expected when I was 24 and went to the Antarctic, or that society up to this day or my family expected, but it has become very fulfilling. Stigma does exist and must be addressed face on. Many of us, people with schizophrenia, live in a perpetual state of fear. I'm not afraid of what the public thinks. I honestly don't care. For those of you that know of my indiscretion in Antarctica as a meteorite hunter looking for meteorites when I was 24, you know that I care more about what penguins think than what society thinks. Because, sadly, I know most people at their best don't think very highly of us. I get depressed each time I read an article in what seems a constant stream of negative articles in the press. As an example, during the coverage of the announcement, is there anyone from Global in here? I'm going to slam Global. Announcement of my receiving the Order of Canada on Global, a well-known female news announcer almost choked on the word as though she was throwing up the word schizophrenia when she had to say it. Then when the journal ran the story of the announcement, the photo they chose was the most uncomplimentary one they had in their file. They had much nicer pictures of me, but ran the one where my hair was standing straight up and my eyes were in my insane scientist mode. In both these cases, I believe that the negative slants were because the media always seems to focus on the negative when it comes to us. I do so enjoy rattling their reality with positive articles about schizophrenia. In my opinion, the only solution for the negativity so common in the media is to have a constant stream of positive news releases to go out from the consumer, family, medical organizations, and professional organizations highlighting positive achievements. Other disabilities do this, and other medical conditions do this continually. It is not easy at times to allow myself to be so public and identifiable as having such a serious and discriminated mental illness such as schizophrenia. I can't count how many times, while in the middle of a joint research paper or abstract, my research partner, because I started before the internet, so I evolved writing papers in the area of space science, my research partner abruptly cuts off communication because they have found out about my illness. I have learned to take such things in stride. The only partner that didn't immediately cut off communication when she found out about my illness was my wife. Her response was, "That's interesting, so what?" I thought maybe she had heard the word schizophrenia and didn't know what it meant. What I didn't know is that she had an extensive background in dealing with individuals with mental illness and has the ability to completely separate me from my disease. When I do like something, like I ask her if she thinks CSIS is bugging the phone, she just says, "No, dear, but if you think that, you could spend less time on the phone." But of course they do bug Order of Canada recipients, so we won't go into that. When she gives speeches about what it is like to be married to a schizophrenic, that's the first point she always tries to make, that you have to be able to separate the actions caused from the illness from the core of the person. She calls my little idiosyncratic ways just a colorful part of my character. The second thing she always says is that no, she doesn't have schizophrenia. That's usually the first question that people ask her when they meet. And they don't ask it, that's because they automatically assume that she also has it, because that's the only person that would marry a person with schizophrenia is another person with schizophrenia. There is the inherent prejudice that a seemingly normal person would never willingly marry somebody with this illness. And that is very common. Such is the stigma that we deal with every day. A person who would never think of asking the spouse of a deaf person if they could hear, or the spouse of a blind person if they could see, will automatically assume that my wife must have a screw loose to be married to me. But she might, because I do have a few screws loose. So, am I not speaking into the mic enough? I have to lean over. The stigma can come in many shapes and guises. When I talk to family members of the newly diagnosed individuals, I try to obviously give them comfort in what may be the hardest time they will ever face in their lives. What I try to stress to them is that while their daughter's son may never be able to lead what most of society considers a normal life, they can live a stable, healthy, and happy life within the limitations that the illness and their medications allow. I have been blessed to be born in a country with a health system that allows me to have access to state-of-the-art treatments. I shudder to think of what my life would have been like if I had been born in the third world. With every new generation of medication that comes down the pipe, my world, my life has expanded. The old medications allowed me to survive. Haldol, Flagsol. Those are the old style in the early 90s. The next wave allowed me to function. Those were the risperidone tablets, olanzapine tablets, what are called atypical neuroleptics. The latest medication change has allowed me to thrive. I believe we are on a cusp of time when treatments will have to involve more than just compliance with treatment, because you're starting to hear of people talking about recovery in the literature when the medications allow people that generations ago would have just been locked up to actually resume somewhat of a healthy life. Maybe not normal, maybe not all working full time, but they at least can function somewhat normally. And that new medication was risperidone consta, which is the injectable form of risperidone tablet, which is different in its application because it is affected differently by the liver when it's uptaked, so it has it's much more efficacious. There was a time when anyone given the diagnosis of AIDS knew it was a death sentence. They would cash in their life insurance, go on one last trip, prepare their affairs, and wait to die. Then the triple cocktail happened, and they started to live and actually had to start living again. Before my last medication, I slept for 12 to 14 hours every day. When I was awake, I had to ingest enormous quantities of coffee in order to function, 7 to 10 cups of coffee a day. When I started Consta, I began to sleep only 7 to 8 hours. That means I was awake 40 hours more a week than I used to be. Imagine that. Of course, the first thing people think when I tell them that is that now I can go out and get a full-time job. That's what a lot of my friends are being encouraged to do. Unless you live with this disease, it is hard to understand what the stress of a full-time job can do to you. I have a friend in Alberta Hospital. That's Alberta Hospital, Edmonton. That's the large psychiatric hospital just outside Edmonton. Right now, who has been working for over 15 years. Part-time. The boom and labor shortage are pushing employers to push part-time employees into full-time or more work. He wasn't up to it. This is why I stress that we should strive for stable and healthy, not necessarily normalcy as society defines it. Most individuals who deal with the homeless will tell you that the mentally ill and chemically dependent make up the largest portion of those labeled hard to house. The newly announced provincial incentive to end homelessness will obviously be a great help, especially to the newly homeless working poor who have been caught in the housing vice that the boom has caused. Money is also important to house those traditionally hard to house, but money alone will not solve this problem. The most important part of the formula has to be adequate supports. What is called an integral part of that is assertive community treatment teams. Access to treatment beds and transitional housing options have to be a solution for the plan for homelessness to work. Supportive housing. There are those who believe that the first step to permanent housing for the mentally ill is the housing. Those who have never experienced the dark veil of mental illness have difficulty understanding that the individual needs to be stabilized on their medication before they have a chance of successfully beating homelessness. I recently had the opportunity to help a young man who was on his own in an apartment for the first time. He was 34. He had lived in the shelter, being homeless, and in various very bad rooming houses in the inner city. The young man had always a strong family support, was fairly stable on medication, and yet still had trouble with even basic living skills needed to be successful in just managing a 200-square-foot apartment. For example, when his phone was connected, it wasn't working properly, and he had no clue how to deal with getting it fixed. Had he been in an active phase of his schizophrenia, it would have been difficult, if not impossible, for him to have dealt with living on his own, let alone flourishing there. It is naive to believe that a mentally ill individual can keep track of their medication while living on the street. The medication gets lost, stolen, or simply ruined by the weather. The only medications which can be realistically used for the homeless are the long-acting injectable neuroleptics. Though that is for, I'm not, in the paper yesterday, they gave the impression I was talking about all homelessness need to get injections. I meant all the homeless schizophrenics, being a big distinction. Flangsol, which is an older generation injectable, or Risperidol Consta. There are some new injectables that are being tested, specifically olanzapine, which is a long-acting agent of an atypical generation of medication. But it is not on the market yet, but is being tested and will likely be approved fairly quickly. They can be administered in a safe, clean place and will allow social workers to know immediately when a client has missed their medications. For the new initiative to have a chance of working, all the new injectables approved by the federal government should be added to the provincial formulary. It has gone to the committee now 3 times and not been approved by the, I won't go into that, but it has not been approved. Leaving these critical medications off the formulary is like sending a soldier off to war without ammo for his weapon. I believe that for that segment of the homeless population that has a serious mental illness, homelessness should be viewed as part of their medical condition. Just viewing homelessness as a problem of simple supply and demand, bricks and mortar, covers up some really complex mental health problems that were the cause of the person becoming homeless in the first place. This doesn't take into account those individuals who are too ill to even understand they are ill and need to take medication. Passage of Bill 31, which he was referring to that article where it was quoted 5 times in the legislature, with the enforcement of community treatment orders, which is enforced administering of medication, which is a very serious thing to do and should not be taken lightly, but in some cases it's necessary, can be an integral part of the success of the $1 billion investment into homelessness. In other jurisdictions, some untreated schizophrenics have been helped, specifically BC, have been helped by community treatment orders to great success. We would not allow in our families those with Alzheimer's to wander the streets homeless. And of course, I'm not talking about my dad or any of the people that are white-haired in the audience. Of course not. Of course not. But we wouldn't allow you to wander around the streets homeless if something happened to you. We would never think twice about obtaining a court guardianship to help an elderly person. But when the afflicted person is young and the illness like schizophrenia, we sometimes balk at the illness, at the idea as a society of forcing them to take medication. We don't think it is our place to interfere with their right to refuse treatment. but the part of their brain that is broken is actually the part that can distinguish between taking the medication or not. Their insight is broken, whereas a person that refuses to take heart medication, their brain is still functioning in most cases, and they're able to make that decision, you know, corpus menti. I supported the passage of this bill because I want the comfort of knowing that if I become that ill again and am too sick to know I need to be medicated, which is always a possibility, I've seen it in other people, I want my wife to have the tools she will need to help me at a time when I might not be capable of helping myself. How much time do we have left? 5 minutes. A couple of other details. Schizophrenia affects 1% of the population. Bipolar affects between 3 to 4% of the population. That's manic depression. 1 out of 5 people at some point in their life will become mentally ill. So it does affect us. At least 2 of the tables in this room statistically will have suffered some sort of mild or major form of mental illness at some point in their life. So it's not a matter of affecting a segment of society. It has touched probably people in this room, close family members, maybe yourself, with depression or some sort of illness. These things, when they occurred before, in previous generations, people were just locked up. They had to be warehoused. We made a decision as a society to allow people to be integrated back into the community. We have to allow, if we're not willing to treat people in hospital, we should still therefore treat them in the community. And it's not a matter if anyone knows of somebody with Alzheimer's, you know, it's a difficult decision. Schizophrenia is like Alzheimer's, except at a young age. Even its previous name, dementia praecox, was dementia of the young. You know, and they viewed it as a type of dementedness, similar to what happens in the old. And that paradigm changed under Kraepelin. And to this new concept of schizophrenia. But the thing is that it's ironic that I jokingly say that 4/5 of the world's population that has a serious mental illness doesn't have access to the SSRIs or new types of medication because they live in the third world or second world. The people in the first world that could get access to it and can afford it through government and private health care plans, most of those people, in many cases, don't use that access properly. So it's very ironic that the 4/5 of the population don't get access, and the 1/5 that does, doesn't access it properly. But as far, one last point, and Bridget would probably know this, that 40% of people that take medication don't take it properly. That was told to me by the former chair of the Premier's Council, and that really surprised me. So it's not surprising that 80% of people with schizophrenia don't take their medications properly, being that in the general population, people don't take their medications properly, and they don't, they make mistakes. If a person has diabetes, would anyone in this room question whether they would have to take insulin for the rest of their lives? And yet, 30, 40, 50 years after the introduction of neuroleptics, there is still debate about the efficacy of these medications. What choice do you have? You know, it's either a choice of homelessness, being incarcerated, or medication for the seriously mentally ill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Austin. the Germans would say, guten Appetit. And we'll return with questions in a few minutes.